escape to the metaverse, but act like you know. You are now tuned into the Matthew and Rizzo show. Escape to the metaverse. Better act like you know. You are now tuned into the Matthew and Rizzo show. Hey everyone, before we begin this week's episode of the Matthew and Rizzo Show, just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Proof of Beauty. Proof of Beauty is an experimental digital experience studio. The blockchain is their canvas and the tokens are their brush. You can learn more about Proof of Beauty by checking out pob.studio. You can follow them on Twitter as well at prrfbeauty. That's PRRF Beauty on Twitter and pob.studio on their homepage to learn more about their projects like Hash, London, and Publico. Thank you and enjoy the show.
Okay. MLO.art, aka Martin, welcome to the Matthew and Rizzo Show.
Thanks so much for having me. Really excited to be part of it.
Yeah. I've been super excited for this conversation. I'm a history buff. And in particular, talking about crypto art history is something that I don't think happens nearly enough. And I don't think nearly enough folks in the space are informed. So that's one angle that I was always excited to talk to you about. But then you're an artist, you're a creator, you're a man that wears many hats. But before we get into all that good stuff, I'm just wondering for everyone listening, if you could introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your background and maybe your creative journey into the crypto space.
Sure. So I'm a new media and crypto artist based in Montreal, Quebec. Let's start maybe way back. So when I was in high school, a friend of mine whose father worked in IT gave me like a Photoshop 2.0 CD and said like, hey, play with it. And I started playing with it, got super excited. And it led basically that I started working in a web agency at the age of 15. 2 years later, I shifted into print. And at the age of 18, I kind of found my own little agency, which I kept, working in like as a side gig next to like high school, university, and my J jobs for over 20 years. And it really kind of shifted me towards like using digital tools, always in a creative way. And it also fostered a very adventurous side of me because, you know, I was like young. I basically had to deal with clients and I would say like, hey, we want to do an e-commerce. Can you do that? And I would say, yeah, absolutely. And I've never done an e-commerce before. So what I would do is I would typically order like the same day books, read these books, and then, you know, hustle my way through to make it and spend countless nights, you know, starting to teach myself how to program, develop, and make these things. And this is something which got stuck to me, you know, like I can learn very easily, or I'm passionate reading and learning with books. So later on, I studied media management in Germany. That's where I grew up, in the Black Forest, which turned out to be way more management than media. After that, I worked in aviation for 5 years, and I reached a point where I wanted to go abroad and live abroad and experience new things. So I decided to make a master's, which forces me to go abroad, so nothing can, you know, prevent me from going. And I ended up studying international business development. And while I was working for that, while I was working in a company as an intern, they decided to buy a company in Canada and said, hey, you want to go to Canada to do that? And I said, well, why not go with the flow? And I just decided to go to Canada. That's where I live now since 9 winters. And I haven't found my way back since. When I first moved to Canada, I ended up in Ottawa, which is, you know, the, for a lot of people, still don't know it, it's the capital of Canada. And I went to like endless gallery crawls, museums, and it really brought me back into like a more artistic practice that I really started like, you know, painting again, like in a more, let's say, structured way to kind of develop the body of work and to start exhibiting and develop it really towards a career. And I started with the traditional trajectory, you know, with participating in group exhibitions, getting first solo exhibition, participating in contests and so on, and connecting with the community. And while I was doing that, I got interested in cryptocurrencies. So that was about 2017, you know, with the big gold rush in ICOs and everything. I started reading a lot about it and got me really into the rabbit hole. I didn't invest much in 17, but I was observing a lot and I was reading, you know, like countless books, which really kind of shifted me towards like this technology behind it, which was tremendously fascinating. And I started really looking for art applications. So I discovered like, you know, first platforms like Monograph and was looking actually for things, what could you do with it in the art environment and art context. So that's when in April, when Known Origin and Super Rare appeared, I was super excited and shot them right away a message. And that's how I started basically creating digital art, because I used digital tools before. Most of my processes can take a long time to complete. I kind of find it very intriguing if things, you know, are not generated very quickly, but are like conceptually interesting or the process is interesting. It often allows like for, you know, quite intriguing textures, patterns. So things which take a long time were always very, very interesting and intriguing to me. And shifting into that space, I kind of had already the knowledge of how to use digital tools, but I didn't want them necessarily to be the only tools I create with, but I use them always to kind of conceptualize and to validate my concept before I would embark like on a multi-year adventure to create a piece. So in the beginning, when I started tokenizing, it was more kind of like explorative. I kind of really drew like on a tablet or and just tried to visualize, you know, certain aspects of the blockchain I started to understand. And then it became conceptually more and more rich, where I tried, you know, to examine like kind of misconceptions, where I tried to dig deeper into technical aspects, trying to understand them and also trying to use my art to explain them to others. And in this kind of environment, I decided like, this is it, you know, like I found kind of like a body of work, something that motivates me, kind of like an overarching theme, which became then my body of work, which I called like Network of Hope, which really evolves around the idea of teaching and educating the general public about this technology with my art. And in this setting, I discovered that clouds were for me the perfect symbolism. You had like clouds, which are, you know, constant transformation, like the blockchain, every block is added. It's never the same. It's evolving continuously. It is basically an entirely intangible environment. And at the same time, it is also some sort of manifestation. So people believe in it. That's why it appears. When people stop believing in it and they would disconnect their nodes, basically this whole ecosystem could also just disappear and collapse. And I thought this fragility is really interesting to express it through clouds. It's something which is very international. You know, people can relate to it. It has a lot of symbolism, which is in almost all cultures on the positive side, almost like a deity or something. And it's very rich to explore. And in addition to that, I had also like a very personal relationship to clouds. I moved over 30 times by now, lived in 3 countries. So I never was really rooted to like physically. I was never really rooted in a physical place, but like rather, you know, my constant was always the sky. And, you know, traveling and flying were like always kind of like very intertwined with me. I was born in Poland, And at the age of five, my family flew basically communist Poland to emigrate or like to rejoin my family in Germany. So my first flight at the age of four was kind of like life-changing, if you want to, you know, and then fast forward later, I'm back on the plane to move to Canada. So it's like kind of always interconnected. And if I look back, you know, it wasn't until way later I discovered like this is kind of like a thread in my life, you know, like my first job, my first like job after university, I was working in aviation, you know, and now I work like in product management for a company, which basically allows me to fly every 2-3 weeks. And it's kind of always around me. And while I was flying, I think by now I work like I'm starting my 7th year in this company, which I'm still working on. I made like over 300 something flights with them by now. And in these flights, I started really like recording and photographing the clouds because I thought, you know, we're kind of experiencing a perspective which not a lot of people see on a frequent basis. And you can discover and find, you know, nuances in that or like patterns and colors, which, you know, which as the entirety of a body of work would be like tremendously interesting to use it as material. So that's where this whole body of work developed, and that's where or how I came about to making art with clouds. And 2 years ago, or no, it was last year, I was in at an art residency here in Canada, and I was creating outside with ink, and it started raining. And I was like, you know, initially very like upset that the rain would kind of like destroy all the work I was making. But I kind of had then the epiphany that I actually started co-creating through with my subject, you know, like rain is just basically a manifestation of clouds. And I think this is an avenue I kind of want to explore more and really conceptually create with rain.
Yo, that's fascinating, actually, man. I love the way you sort of like piece that together with the clouds and the rain. Dude, your angle on like blockchain based art is actually something I've like given a lot of thought to lately, and was came up yesterday. Actually, I was doing a Twitter Spaces with Nicole Vertical Crypto Art, and you know, the blockchain is like very interesting because it allows, as you know, man, I'm like preaching to the choir. It allows people to like create a form of like art that wasn't previously possible, because you can actually, you know, use elements of the blockchain and of programming to create the art. And it's interesting, man, because I feel like when I think of people approaching like crypto art, whatever you want to call it, NFTs, from that angle, the first person that comes to mind is Nate Alex, who I think is very much like programmer first, artist second. But you seem to like really like straddle the line of like having a lot of contemporary art skills, but also like using the blockchain itself and like elements of the blockchain to produce art. So I'm just curious, man, like, did you know, you've been in the space for a while now, like, who else do you see, or like, do you like, you know, I don't want to say like imitate, but like, you know, look towards like for like inspiration? Like, I feel like even though we're in this space where we have this like tremendous medium where we can produce art that like really hasn't been able to be produced before, there's really like a very small handful of people who are doing that. Otherwise, you got people, not that there's anything wrong with it, like, you know, literally just tokenizing digital art that isn't inherently dependent on the blockchain to be produced. So yeah, man, like what's your take on like the landscape of people and, you know, the, you know, sort of viewpoints on people who are using the blockchain to produce art like that?
Yeah, I think, you know, two people which really stand out to me in this environment is definitely Ria Myers and Kevin Abosh. I think with Ria, it was like, I remember it was I think the end of 2018, and they had like an event here in Montreal, the Canadian Center for Architecture, and they were looking for artists who work in that medium, and I was working for like several months, you know, making a generative piece which uses the block hashes to create, you know, some sort of generative visualization. So I work on that like for months, you know, and like I am there, I'm super excited to meet other people. But as it turned out, I was like the only artist, which was kind of disappointing. But it was still like, you know, a great way to work on it. And then, you know, I kind of discover about a week or 2 weeks later after the event that Ria Myers did something like 4 years before me. It's like, wow, you know, this is like, there's been people which were working with that medium already like for a really long time and examining it and playing with it in such a, you know, conceptual way, way before everybody even had an idea that you can make art with it or, you know, end up with something which will be called NFTs. So I think Ria, you know, like was playing more conceptually with it, you know, like her, one of her conceptual pieces, which I kind of found interesting, was like, it's called This Contract is Art, which is really like a smart contract as a conceptual art piece, which you could trigger with a transaction basically and change the statement that this contract is or is not art. And like, it was elements like that, which I found like tremendously intriguing, you know, that you would kind of use this technology to kind of really experiment and express just new forms, you know, of art. Like who would have thought that, you know, like, blockchain transaction can basically determine, you know, like a discussion around like, is this art or not? And I think Kevin Abash was also for me somebody who was very, very innovative. You know, he created like, I think 2013 or something already, like books around like the idea of like a bank, you know, like that your wallet can become some sort of a bank. And, you know, he did like coin projects where he kind of issued basically his own currencies and play with value definitions and the idea of what we use it for and how we use it and who's entitled to own it and have it. I think all the way, you know, to where we see now, it's kind of, I see it as a little bit of like an eye of a tornado where we kind of are like in a very, very quiet zone where everything just revolves around NFTs while before and after, and I think after, we're going to have again like a bigger and bolder exploration, which is going to be, maybe NFTs will be part of it, but the whole discussion will not revolve around it, but we will use it more conceptually and in a wider scale again.
I love that. So actually my question right now, it goes back way back, and it's way more fundamental, and it's something that I've been curious about, and I know that you've been tinkering on and theorizing on, but I'd really love to hear your definition of crypto art and sort of contrast that with some of the other forms of art, whether it's digital art, blockchain art, NFT art, NFT collectibles, and kind of really unpack your theory of crypto art.
Sure. So I think in order to get there, we maybe have to divert for just a few seconds on where it really came from, you know, like how it started all with this cypherpunk movement where people kind of, you know, discovered in this environment blockchain technology and thought like, hey, this is, you know, this is great. This aligns kind of with our values of like, you know, self-governance, privacy, the right to choose, to remain anonymous, and how that kind of created a base of values which kind of cascaded through the early years of crypto or blockchain art. How then, you know, from something which was entirely conceptual and abstract, how that kind of required people to have something tangible, and how it then evolved towards like having physical coins, you know, which became kind of like discussion pieces for people, which evolved to like an entire, you know, economy around physical bitcoins and physical coins, to the extent that there was like even like an encyclopedia produced around it, which was featuring, I think, like 56 different manufacturers of these physical coins, which really kind of demonstrated the need that it needed to kind of express itself some sort of physically. From there on, it kind of shifted towards like, you know, inviting artists to like these early blockchain conferences and meetups and commission them to kind of reinterpret the theme or technical aspects to it. Because, you know, back then in the early years, everything related with blockchain was like absolutely a guarantee to reduce your circle of friends, or, you know, to be like, be the loner at parties because nobody wanted to talk with you about it. And when the whole controversy about Silk Road came up, you know, this black marketplace, which then Ross Ulbricht was like penalized draconically, it gave a lot of people the opportunity to kind of dismiss this technology, right? So people were even forced or forced even more to stick together and kind of, you know, were able to only talk with each other around it. And I think out of that environment, a lot of the early art kind of evolved, where it was really kind of like, to one extent, documenting the history of blockchain art or blockchain itself. It was kind of mimetic, you know, it was exploring themes of like activism. And that is what I call like, was like a thematic examination. And that is something which for me always was like blockchain related art, typically physical. There was a component to it, which just used blockchain as a payment method, which doesn't seem necessarily, or crypto as a payment method, which doesn't seem very, you know, innovative now. But if you go back like 5-6 years ago, and there was like, you know, artists which are really like playing like on the forefront of the art world, saying like, hey, my connection is only available for Bitcoin, you know, that made international news. And I think in that extent, it is for me also some sort of blockchain related, because you're using at least this aspect of like activism, or like promoting it, which then gives it a bigger exposure and introduces people to this concept. And the last aspect of this blockchain related art for me was, you know, kind of use it as some sort of provenance for physical art. And that was kind of how I see everything around blockchain related art. Then if you add a layer to it and you bring it to like digital art, and, you know, then would you have, for instance, I don't know, like a screensaver, which would be paid in Bitcoin, but which is neither necessarily tokenized, or it's not necessarily thematically engaging with blockchain, but it's just using it as a payment and it's digital. But if you go then further and say like, okay, what happens if now this digital art is either using the technology itself to create, let's say it's like an artwork which uses a smart contract, or you create like an art token like Neely Lerner did in 2014 with her Neely coins, you know, then you enter for me the sphere of crypto art, because you're kind of conceptually using this technology to create art. And it's a digital, natively digital medium, and you create digital art, which kind of interacts to some sort of extent with the blockchain. And then out of this crypto art environment is a subset, which is for me NFT art. It is not necessarily entirely overlapping with crypto art, because there's a lot of interesting and old and conceptual crypto art which is not an NFT, and there's a lot of NFT art which is, or NFTs which are not art at all, right, which are collectibles, or they are like metaverse plots or wearables or whatever. So I think I kind of see really NFT art is like a subset of crypto art, which is really something much, much bigger. And I kind of hope that, you know, we would kind of take a moment and really look into the history of crypto art to kind of see how rich it is, how old it is. And we would stop using NFTs and crypto art synonymously, because I think for me, as somebody who has looked into the history a little bit more, we kind of reduce crypto art with the NFTs terms, while it is much, much bigger and wider.
Oh, I like that, man. And I agree, you know, upon hearing your take on the landscape and everything on what should be encompassed in the term crypto art, I'm with it 100%. Dude, I feel like you've given a lot more thought to the history aspect of this whole scene, more than a lot of people. And it's something that I'm like very fascinated by. I know, I know Matt is as well. We've had Proof of Beauty on here, and that's like their whole angle on the space. But again, man, I feel like not a lot of people are thinking about, dude, in your opinion, man, what are like important things that are like commonly overlooked or like, you know, misconceptions, or, you know, I'm curious, you know, as someone who is sort of like a history buff on the space, like, are there certain things that you feel like people don't appreciate or understand or are missing out on or like need to be given more of a voice? What's your take?
I think right now we are still in a discussion where we're exploring the past, right? There's still a lot of projects and chains which are not fully examined. And, you know, as it became lucrative and interesting for people to look into the older projects, I think we're still going to explore a lot of new things which we have not heard about before or forgotten. So it is a really, very dynamic environment where almost every week we discover something new. But if you would kind of generalize it, I think, you know, we can kind of bring it back to that. Probably the NFT discussion is something which started in 2013-14, which one of the first, you know, was basically creating an NFT out of the Bitcoin logo. And, you know, then you have like a whole area of individuals which kind of examined or played with NFTs or the idea of NFTs in 2014, and which are kind of arguing currently who was really the first, which is, you know, another entire discussion on itself. But I think elements which I think are interesting are, for instance, the big quantum controversy. I think it's something which people should know about. Why is it important? Because when Kevin McCoy created his first NFT in 2014, which was called Quantum, it was basically tokenized on the Namecoin, and it was later on bought by somebody. There was, however, you know, like a controversy around what is really an NFT and what is Namecoin. Is a Namecoin really like a blockchain to the extent that it can host NFTs, or is it more like some sort of domain serving provider, you know, the way you kind of have like a subscription model? So that led him to basically tokenize Quantum again this year with a big auction house. And that really, really was, I think, a huge controversy in the space where people were like, what is this? You know, there's something which is already tokenized, which is owned by somebody, and now we're tokenizing the same thing again. And it really kind of triggered a lot of people. I know that some people were extremely harsh with Kevin as well, you know, like to the extent that it was like, I don't know, threats or whatever. But I think that is maybe an element which is not necessarily known to a lot of people. You know, because Quantum was then at one stage considered as like one really, you know, a fine art NFT, or like one of the first fine art NFTs, and having this controversy around its origin and basically retokenizing it is something which I think is going to be still discussed for a while until it comes to some sort of consensus. And I think that alone is something which is worth mentioning. For me personally, I think seeing crypto art developing towards a movement was really passing these individual people playing with NFTs, but moving towards like the community-driven projects like Rare Pepes and their Asian kind of forks, Memory Chain and Oasis Mining, which were like really people who are interested in art and crypto, which maybe played with these early NFT or blockchain games, and which kind of wanted, you know, I know from one, for instance, he was continuously trying to pitch designs to, for instance, Spells of Genesis, you know, and got rejected every time. And then these people kind of found in Rare Pepe a safe haven, basically, where they had like an environment where they could, you know, create without judgment and tokenize and develop really crypto art towards like a community project and towards a movement, towards something which is fun, which is, you know, mimetic, which really brought in people from all over the world and stopped it from being something which is driven by individuals, but is really kind of uniting people and bringing people together as a theme. And I think that is, for me, still, you know, we had a lot of progress with the Rare Pepe project, you know, which was due to its controversy with around Pepe the Frog, greenwashed for a long time. You know, I remember in 2018, there were these like crypto environment charts where they show like, okay, these are the projects in finance, these are the projects in art, and of all these, you know, Pepe suddenly disappeared when these controversies started around the alt-right movement and when they kind of misappropriated Pepe. And I think, you know, it was very disappointing for the people who were in this space, because Pepe itself was always like a very positive figure. You know, it was like always an element which was the guidelines was that it was, you know, it was always like a safe for work and kind of like a positive environment. And I think throughout the controversy, and this is where this comes full circle, is when then these protests in Hong Kong started, you know, Pepe became again their symbol, a symbol of hope, and it became very popular there. And to the extent, you know, that we had now Matt Fury, the creator of Pepe the Frog, really joining the Pepe community in creating his Pepe card, which was always reserved for him, but which he repeatedly refused to acknowledge or comment on for like years, you know. So I think to the extent he acknowledged that really the Pepe community really stayed with Pepe throughout all these controversies. And so it was kind of fun to see how it came full circle, that he basically, as the creator, which kind of tolerated the Rare Pepes, but never really expressively or acknowledged it or kind of took a stance on it, that he basically in the end then creates the own deck of his card, which was always reserved for him. That was, I think, a very, very great moment for a lot of people in, you know, in this space who kind of followed it, because it's kind of like coming to terms with it. So other than that, I think, these were, I think, maybe kind of the projects which I would definitely highlight.
Definitely. And God, I would love to grab like all the beers in the world with you and just like talk about the history and these seminal moments and all that good stuff. But man, we still need to talk about your art and your practice and your method, which I think is really intertwined with how you've approached the documentation recording of crypto art history and how deeply you've thought about how it's differentiated between the NFT art and all like blockchain art and digital art and all that good stuff. Like over the course of this conversation, like your art has really become more synonymous with who you are as a person, with me personally getting to know you more. So mm-hmm. I know before we started recording, you leaked some alpha in January, hopefully, tentatively, always TBD, always soft dates. You have a pretty massive project under works with Async Art. I'm just wondering if you could sort of unpack for folks what you're planning there, what they can expect. Give the good folks listening to the Matthew and Rizzle show some alpha on that front.
Sure. So maybe before we get to the specific drop, we need to kind of cover the background a little bit. I was always tremendously fascinated that people in the crypto space, there was a lot of people who have never thought about like investing and money in general. And I think what really fascinated is me, you know, you have like now this whole new wave of first-time investors, of people who are either believing in it or want to, you know, kind of improve their financial situation. So for the first time in their life, they're investing into something, right? Which is tremendously fascinating. But with that newness to the subject matter, it comes also, you know, this uncertainty. And with this uncertainty, you know, certain patterns repeat itself that, you know, these people have not necessarily fully understood what investing means and don't not necessarily understand what fluctuation is. And that led to, you know, to something which fascinated me tremendously, is like just this regular checking of the of the exchange rates to the point of obsession. You know, like it's like people, and you see them, you know, sometimes you're like in every situation, but you see sometimes people pulling out and just checking what is Bitcoin at, what is Ethereum at, and you know, a lot of people do that so often, which is kind of like, it really becomes like an obsession. I made a lot of pieces which really played around that theme and explored it, you know, using blockchain data and creating kind of like visualizations where it develops, creating like trend curves and the newest drop with Async is kind of like an evaluation of several pieces which I've created over the past few years, where I wanted to bring that basically to another level, and create a fully functional chart, which is kind of removing, you know, this kind of like anxiety inducing red bars and green bars and numbers, but like really exploring it with my subject matter, the clouds, and creating something which is more serene, more just a more relaxing way of if you still need to check it, you know, there's a way for you to do it without getting necessarily your blood rate or your heart pressure rate up to the point that it's not good for you. And with Async, we started this project in June 2020. And it was like a long path, you know, finding the right algorithm, finding a way to kind of visualize it. And it was a lot of tweaking, a lot of back and forth. It was very, very difficult, or let's say hard on the hardware requirements for Async 2. So it is exciting in that regard that it might be for a while the last piece which goes into such complexity that it really takes this live data, visualizes it every hour. So that's something which I'm like very excited about, that A, the team was willing to go with me on this long path, exploring it, playing with it, tweaking it, but at the same time, you know, still open to it, that even if it's like very heavy on the resource side, that they're still willing and open to do it. So this piece, which is called the Serene Charts of Obsession, will be basically a cloud-based visualization of the trend curve of a currency you can choose, either between the Bitcoin trend or the Ethereum trend. It will be displaying a full day and night cycle. So you have, you know, sunsets, you have a sun cycle, you have a night cycle where the moon is going up and down, and you have basically some sort of visual opportunities to kind of change the look and feel of this chart. And for the owner of the master, you can basically geolocate your chart for yourself. So if you're somebody who lives in Australia and you want your chart to follow the Australian day and night cycle, you can basically set it to your place. And that's, I think, in a very, very vague, I think. It's hard to kind of explain it without a visual. But you saw it. I don't know if it kind of brings it to the point or if I'm still missing something.
No, man. I think you explained it pretty well. I mean, dude, I feel like I'm like behind the ball in terms of like trying to acquire a piece that does anything remotely like what yours is doing. I love this concept of like these pieces of art that sort of change over time or are tied to like, you know, exterior characteristics that like manipulate the image in some way. And the piece is beautiful, man. You know, we'll have to make sure we got some images attached or some links when the podcast goes out and everything. But dude, with the amount of time that you put into your work, like knowing that level of detail has been put into this Async piece is like really like sort of mind-blowing, man.
There's also one secret layer which is actually called secret scenarios, where this is a layer which will not be for sale, but it will be triggered by world events, which some of which might happen, some of which hopefully never happened. or never happen, but it will basically, it has some surprise elements to it, which will only unfold when they really happen in reality. And then they're going to be revealed as time moves on.
Awesome, dude. You know, man, you've listened to our podcast before, how we always do sort of like a shakedown towards the end of like what other people are collecting and what they're interested in. And I got to say, man, I'm like absolutely fascinated to know what you collect on the side or what, you know, pops up when you open your wallet. What interests you most these days, man?
So I've always had a lot of art collected. That was always like something which I was the most interested in. I didn't really get much into like these collectibles. I never really got much into gaming because, you know, I kind of always wanted to rather create art or look at art. So I have collected a few like older projects, you know, like back then when I discovered Cura card, a few. I got into from being very, very Ethereum centric, I kind of moved over and I started getting, you know, involved a little bit in the Pepes and Memory Chain. So I got into Counterparty. I collected there a couple of cards, one of which is actually my favorite card. And there's maybe a small story to that. It's basically a Pepe the Frog, which is staring at the sky. Basically just, you know, Pepe the Frog surrounded by clouds. And it was for me, like, you know, absolutely my favorite card because like I basically saw myself. So I kind of really wanted this card and it was like an edition of 100. The artist was unknown or missing in action. So I started to kind of, you know, contacting like dozens and dozens of people, you know, who has like any clues, because there's only three cards in circulation. One of which is, you know, by Joe Looney, who's like the creator of the Rare Pepe wallet and notoriously not somebody who sells cards. So I was like very discouraged but I didn't want to let it go. So I started using Google Translate and engaging in these like Japanese memory chain groups and really trying to like using Google Translate to like ask them in Japanese questions and kind of trying to find the whereabouts of this creator. So after weeks and weeks, finally, I got some leads and it turned out that the creator of this Pepe card is actually a woman. And this woman is somebody who has left the crypto space, who didn't use Twitter like for years. And with the help of this community, I was finally able to track her down. We had like, you know, great conversations to the extent, you know, that I was able to collect some of her cards. I introduced her to some marketplaces, you know, like Scarcity, which was creating kind of like a Rare Pepe centered marketplace. And she was able to sell so many of her cards that she really got back, not only into art, but also into really creating again. And she, when we were at NFT NYC, Scarcity had a small gallery, which was highlighting Rare Pepe art, and she was even creating the poster to it. So it was really kind of like cool to see, you know, that you can bring people basically back into the space. And I think for me, which was really was so fascinating about this whole Rare Pepe and memory chain community, is it was always about like trading. That was the fun aspect to it. You know, these little stories like the one I just told you, this is what this was all about. So it was, you know, when I first started out, I was tremendously frustrated how difficult it was to get into it, because, you know, people were just like sending you links to like super complicated instructions. They really didn't want to help you. But what I kind of understood only later is that this was kind of like a protection mechanism to kind of guarantee the integrity of the community. You know, they wanted to make it difficult that if you really are interested into it, if you really go out of your way and discover these projects, you know, get your Counterparty or get your Rare Pepe Cash and learn to use these exchanges or the DEX or, you know, then you can be part of this. And I think that was what was tremendously appealing to me. And, you know, we had this year with this whole high wave of NFTs, there was like moments where you kind of saw this community aspect slip away a bit. But I think now that, you know, courses are, or like the exchange rates are going down and there seems to be, you know, some sort of crypto winter maybe coming, or like it brings out a lot of the speculators, and the discussion is coming back again towards the art. So, but I kind of went on a tangent there. So other than crypto art on Ethereum, I started collecting some of the cards like Rare Pepes and Memory Chain, Oasis Mining. And then I started with Tezos, specifically Hickenang and artworks on FX Hash, which is becoming some sort of like the Tezos-based equivalent to art blocks, where you can get some really interesting, intriguing, generative or algorithmic artworks, which are still very, very affordable. So I kind of got a lot into that. And I have a hard time keeping crypto in my wallet because I have a tendency to spend it all on art.
I just have to say, the story that you shared earlier with the Pepe looking at the clouds and your saga of how you were able to eventually get in contact with her and then bring it full circle this year, NFT NYC, having her participating again and creating again. Those are the stories that keep me in the space.
Yeah.
Those are the stories that make this space so magnificently rich. Exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this totally made my day when I heard that, and she sent me then, you know, artwork she created again. You know, she was like, she was working a corporate job in Japan, you know, and then she really gave up on the space. And then, you know, just people showing interest in her art,
yeah,
and, you know, having basically the recognition, you know, selling a few cards here and there, and it really brought her back. And I think that is so fascinating. And it was also like, you know, it's I personally always found it very appealing when other creators would collect my art. And I think that is also something which is very validating or rewarding.
No, 100%. And I mean, again, just that's one story of many. That reminds me, like, very in a direct way to what blackbox.art had impact on Matt Cain. When Matt Cain had stopped creating after minting a number of works early on in Super Rare, blackbox.art stumbled upon his work, made a bid on it, brought him back. And then next thing you know, like, Matt Cain is coming back, and he sold that one piece to Conlon. Conlon took the piece, created the Rose Nexus and the Conlon District and Crypto Voxels, which then attracted so many more people into the space and had this chain reaction. I love these stories, man.
Yeah. I mean, the whole, like, when I started with this crypto art history overview, I mean, the stories you undig there is just phenomenal. You know, like, one of the interesting stories, you know, the Last Supper or the First Supper, the first async piece, right? Yeah. I didn't know before I really dig deep into it that, like, almost all of the creators were actually the first renter of Conlon's parcels. You know, these were the creators he approached first. And, like, these are the stories which I find are so intriguing, you know, like Block Party was a ticketing system before, you know, Nifty Gateway was basically the credit card provider for Non-Origin before. And I think seeing where these projects start and where they evolve is just so fascinating that, you know, that alone is just, you can talk for hours about these little things and backgrounds, who did what before and how they shifted and how it changes. And I think, it's definitely enriching this whole thing, this whole environment. And I totally agree, you know, like, there's so many stories to be told. There's just not enough time, and putting it together is kind of a fun project.
Yeah, well, I think we have like a part two coming up at some point where we just need to go through like our favorite stories in the space. I think honestly, that would be the play. People would love to listen to these stories that we've all been a part of and witnessed and have picked up in our time here.
I'm just glad he's the guy who's taking on this project. Like, if there's anyone who's like the right person to do this, it's you, man. Like, you're the guy. So, you know, please continue what you're doing, man. It's I feel like this is tremendously important work, honestly, man. And I'm glad you're the one doing it.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I kind of try to focus, you know, there's a lot of like NFT archaeologists, which are focusing on collectibles. But for me, it was always the fascinating aspect to find and see this intersection with the traditional art world, right? Because when I first stumbled upon NFTs, it was like, okay, for me, that is the vehicle which might ride us into the traditional art world. So I was naturally very interesting, you know, on the first exhibitions, the first artists, the first, you know, like how are the institutional players in the art world interacting with it? And I think it's a little bit of a different angle, but for me, it is, I think, the more fascinating part of it than necessarily, you know, like an investment opportunity.
100%. And for everyone here curious to learn more and dig more into the history, Martin has a fantastic website that contains all that and more. Make sure you check it out. mlo.art. That's mlo.art. It'll take you there and you can find all the links from there. If you want to get into the history right away, mlo.art/history. Dude, Martin, man, as a longtime listener of the Matthew and Rizzo show, it's such an honor to have you on here to pick your brain. As someone who's been in the space for a while and has admired your work, it's been an honor to dig more into your process and to have this opportunity to chat. And like I said, we have to have you back to talk about more of these stories. But I just hope that you keep on creating, keep on doing your thing, man.
Thanks so much. The pleasure is really mine. And I told you so, like, I really respect that, you know, that you're doing that since 2019 and you really became like an institution in the space, and, you know, you keep people educating, and like a lot of people know what they know just because of listening to this podcast. So I hope you as well just keep continuing and keeping us entertained for a long time.
Will do.
Thank you so much, man.
Awesome. Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me, and looking forward to talking more.
Hey everyone. Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Proof of Beauty. Proof of Beauty is an experimental digital experience studio. The blockchain is their canvas and the tokens are their brush. You can learn more about Proof of Beauty by checking out pob.studio. You can follow them on Twitter as well at prrfbeauty. That's prrfbeauty on Twitter and pob.studio on their homepage to learn more about their projects like Hash, London, and Publico. Thank you, and see you in the next episode.